This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in today for Bill Radke. So last night, I was lucky enough to score tickets to see Hamilton at Seattle's Paramount Theater. And at the very end, Alexander Hamilton's widow sings a song, and the refrain goes, "Who lives? Who dies? Who tells your story?" I could add to that, how do they tell that story? Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Underground Railroad, is the story of a young slave named Cora who escapes from a Georgia cotton plantation. It's a historical novel, sure, but the history's enhanced through the craft of storytelling and through the magic of Colson Whitehead's imagination. The Underground Railroad has just come out in paperback. Colson Whitehead, it's an honor to welcome you back to Seattle. Thanks for being here.
Hey, how do you do? Thanks for having me.
This book was originally published in 2016, but I've read that the kernel of the novel actually dates back several years before that. When?
It was the year 2000, and I was sitting on my couch and came across a reference to the Underground Railroad. I remembered how when I was a kid, I thought it was a literal train, which is obviously very impractical. But I thought, you know, wouldn't that just be a weird premise for a story? What could I generate from making this metaphor into a literal Underground Railroad station?
So that's 16 years before the book actually came out. Why did you start writing it at that point?
No, it seemed like a really good idea, and I just didn't think I was a good enough writer, one. I thought if I wrote some more books, I might be able to tackle it in a technical sense. And then I was very mature. I was like 30 years old, you know, hanging out every night, and it just didn't seem that I was mature enough to really sort of deal with slavery and that period in American history and the way it deserved to be treated, so I waited.
Aside from having the sort of confidence that you could tackle this and the technical chops, what kind of historical background or research did you need to do to really bring a story like this to life?
Well, I mean, there are a few histories of the Underground Railroad, not as many as you'd think. But really, my greatest resources were the slave narratives, famous ones, by Frederick Douglass, Harriet Jacobs. And then in the 1930s, the U.S. government was trying to put people back to work and hired writers to capture the life histories, oral histories of former slaves. And it's stuff that wouldn't go into a history book, but for me, you know, provides the nouns and verbs and adjectives that mostly hopefully make it seem alive to modern readers.
So how many years of research did you put in before you actually really started writing?
It was a few months, but I was drawing upon stuff I'd read decades and decades before, like the slave narratives I mentioned, books about forced sterilization, you know, that happened in the 19th century. We sterilized the feeble-minded, people of color, poor people, to keep them from having kids and being a burden. And so once I committed to the idea, it was very fast. The writing was only like a year. And I think it was because it was in the back of my head for so long.
You told me before we went on the air that this is the most sort of linear of the books that you've written. It is, because I mentioned to you, it is a page-turner. It is the story really of this very young girl, to my mind, Cora. She's a teenager when she escapes from this Georgia plantation. And when I stepped back, after, you know, sort of plowing through the book and being so excited to find out what happens to Cora, I thought, Cora, why Cora? Why this young girl?
Sure. I mean, it's my eighth book, and I try to mix things up. And so there's the practical concern that I just had a bunch of male protagonists in a row. And so a voice in the back of my head was saying, don't do the same crap all the time. Colson, people will catch on to your tricks. Yeah. And then Harriet Jacobs, who I mentioned, wrote a slave narrative. And she writes very compellingly about the dilemma of the female slave. When a slave girl becomes a slave woman, she enters into a much more terrible form of slavery. She's now subject to her master's sexual desires, if she wasn't already. And she's supposed to pump out babies, because more babies means more slavery, more property for her master. And so it just seemed a different predicament than face the male slave and worthy of exploring.
Who had equally horrible times.
Yeah, it's different aspects of a very terrible situation.
What is that like psychologically for you to immerse yourself in that world?
Well, it's one thing to say I'm going to write about slavery and then to research it and try to make a story out of it. And so definitely coming to it as a grown-up, as opposed to, say, a kid watching Roots when I was eight or studying history when I was in college. I understood in a different way, you know, the devastation of the enterprise, Trying to imagine what it'd be like to see my children sold off, abused in a way that slaves were abused, vice versa. And so reckoning with the fact that it's really luck that I'm here. You know, my ancestors could have died at this or that juncture on the Middle Passage, on the plantation. And it's really a miracle that they survived to have kids who had kids. And so, you know, the idea is abstract. And then writing the story, it becomes more real and definitely realizing what I'd have to do to Cora, have to do to the supporting cast just to be realistic was caused a lot of despair.
I would imagine so. I'm speaking with Colson Whitehead. He's written, as you mentioned, 8 books, but we're talking today about his novel, The Underground Railroad, which has just come out in paperback. Did you know a lot about your own family's history?
I was never that interested. You know, my mom's side is pretty well documented. And then when the book came out, I'd be sort of asked that, and I'd say, I don't know. And then I had various irate great uncles who'd say, well, you know, this, and this. Don't you know about your great-great-great-great-grandfather Colson, who was a slave in Virginia and worked in a hotel and bought himself out of slavery? My father's mother was from Barbados, which was a sugar plantation island. Mm. So I was never that interested, but since the book has come out, various family members have schooled me in this or that fact I didn't know before.
It's been many decades since I studied American history in school, but I do remember that when we talked about the 19th century America, the war between the North and the South, I know for a fact that we never got to know slaves, people held in slavery, as people. And I'm wondering how the creation, even of a fictional character, but she's representative of things that really happen, how that changes the way that a mainstream America examines its own history.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I play around with history in the book, and there's some fantastic elements. But before I got to that part of the book, I wanted to be realistic and have an accurate portrayal of the plantation. And that means that the slaves are psychologically rich. I think in pop culture, we have an idea about the plantation where we have 100 slaves, and maybe there's one Uncle Tom who's ratting to the master, and everyone's helping each other. And for me, you know, from what we know about PTSD and trauma and what it does, that's not an accurate portrayal of any group of people, let alone people who have been dehumanized. And so the slaves aren't on their best behavior. They've been damaged and traumatized. I try to take different historical episodes and move them out of time and make a different sort of conversation about how America came to be. And you know, it seems that people have been relating to my sort of alternative take on American history.
At one point in the book, Cora ruminates on the fact that America is sort of a series of images, and that maybe it doesn't exist at all as a real place.
Well, on the one hand, we have the Civil War. Then in another part of the country, we have the War of Northern Aggression. So we have different ways of seeing history and interpreting it. And definitely as a kid, we did maybe 10 minutes on slavery and then 40 minutes on Abraham Lincoln. In high school, maybe 10 minutes on segregation and 40 minutes on Martin Luther King. And it's a very sanitized version of history. And depending where you're coming from, whether you've been exposed to how things actually were, we have a different idea of how America came to be.
When I introduced you, I mentioned the line from that Hamilton song, "Who Writes the Story?" And I was thinking in particular about a book that came out when I was probably in college, which was A People's History of America by Howard Zinn. Why does it matter who gets to tell the stories?
Well, I mean, why are there so few novels about the Underground Railroad, novels about Harriet Jacobs, Harriet Tubman, Paul Robeson? You know, these are all sort of incredibly dynamic American figures who've never gotten their due, whether it's just in a movie of the week or a novel or even the kind of nonfiction treatment they deserve. And so these stories haven't been told. So for me, as a storyteller, that means I have a lot of material to work with. Mm. In terms of what we know about our past, it means that we're diminished.
You're a dad. You've got 2 kids. How do you want them to perceive the past of this country and maybe the pathway going forward?
Well, I mean, I hope that maybe instead of 10 minutes on slavery, it's up to 12 now, or, you know, and 38 on Abraham Lincoln. You have to hope that things get better, you know, in the same way that my grandparents hope that their children grow up in a better world than they were born into. I have to hope that we'll come out of our current, I would say, terrible political situation in America, come out on the other side and move to a more progressive place. If you don't have hope, why continue? And that's the hope that animates Cora in the book. She has to believe that there's a place of refuge in the North. And I have to believe, just because, if only because I have kids, that things will get better.
I read that while you write any book, not just this book, that you really go into this state of sort of darkness and despair, and that you were feeling kind of chipper after you won a lot of awards for this. But why do you need to have that state of mind, or is that what writing does to you?
Well, you know, I mean, the process is pretty excruciating, and it's just you. And of course, there are great days when you figure out something new about the character or a new kind of sentence. But I like my little dungeon office, you know, and I have my computer on my couch. I can write a page, weep, lay on the couch, take a depressive nap, write another page, and there you have two pages, and that's two pages more than you had in the morning. And it's not pretty, but it gets the job done.
Do you give yourself a quota?
For me, eight pages a week seems to make sense. So, you know, 1 to 3 pages a day, maybe 4 days a week. And, you know, after a year, that's 400 pages. That's a novel. You write four pages a week. That's 200 a year. 2 years, you have a novel. So I break it down to units. I basically spend my life trying to get through unpleasant things and wondering when they'll be over. And so if I can do 8 pages a week, I know that in 9 months I might be done.
We should tell people you actually willingly chose this profession. You wanted to do this profession.
I didn't have much of a choice. If I could have had a straight job, I would have done that. But I don't have a lot of upper body strength. I'm not good. I'm not really a people person. So jobs that don't require physical exertion and a lot of human contact appeal to me.
So we're really torturing you right now. I know that at 11 o'clock tonight, you're going to be seeing the premiere of Black Panther, which is a major cultural event in America. This is a month before Ava DuVernay's new film, A Wrinkle in Time. In this region, the Seattle area, there's a new organization called Langston that's gearing up with this mission, promoting Black excellence. I could really go on, and I'm wondering, is this a tipping point in American culture? Is this 2018 going to be the year where it's not a step forward and two steps back, but it's forward?
Well, I would have, I think the same kind of articles that we're seeing now came out in 1990 with Spike Lee and John Singleton. Is this a tipping point for Black film? No, I think it's hard to, you know, keep these advantages and progress going. There are a lot, I think, institutional barriers to keeping these great moments going. I think now it's incredible that we have people who grew up on, say, Spike Lee and John Singleton now making movies. But I'm always leery of thinking that now we've made it, because you never know what's around the corner, whether it's a Trump or a recession that pulls back on funding for arts. And I still think that I'll give it a couple years before I sign off on it. So, not to be depressed, not to be negative.
We have to go lay down on that couch some more. Also a generation who grew up on Colson Whitehead.
Yes, I pity them, but I guess, you know, they're out there perhaps. I don't know.
Colson Whitehead is the author of many books. The novel The Underground Railroad has just been reissued in paperback, and it's the winner of the National Book Award, the Pulitzer Prize, and I must add, it's a real page-turner. You should read it. Colson Whitehead will speak tonight at Benaroya Hall. He's here as part of Seattle Arts and Lectures, and then he'll be catching a film, Black Panther, and we're going to hear more about that coming up on the record. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.